You're listening to a podcast produced by the Jackson School of International Studies, the Center for West European Studies, and the European Union Center at the University of Washington. This and other podcasts can be found on iTunes and SoundCloud. For more information, visit us at jsis.washington.edu/EU West Europe.
Thank you all for your endurance. You've helped see me through a long day of. My wife and I actually are able to survive through this era of, I won't say unprecedented heat because it's not in Seattle, despite the neon that is around 80 degrees. We have a heat pump in our house that we installed a couple of years ago when we were remodeling, mostly because I was pushing it very hard. Heat pumps now in Europe are probably selling more than hard candy or soft candy.
Aren't they so expensive there?
They're fairly expensive. And so one of the... this is a spoiler alert for my own talk. So one of the recommendations that's being made to the EU in terms of their energy policy is for government to subsidize, based on income, the purchasing of heat pumps, because they can make such an enormous difference, and they will. They already have in some countries that are fairly well off, like Germany and the Netherlands. Less so in the UK, because the UK is in a different economic situation. But they are spreading quite widely, and they have a lot of very positive press. If you are a homeowner, I would recommend them more than I would solar panels on your roof. They will save you. Yeah, and they also heat, so they do both. But I don't have stock in any of these companies. So. Yeah, until I go home. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about Europe's situation, its energy situation, and how it got into that situation, what the situation means in terms of its security. Energy security is national security. They really can't be divided now, but there are a lot of other security types that enter into that: climate, cyber, and then national defense. Also, they all go together. If you lose electricity, you no longer have a modern state. After 24 hours, and all your food spoils, and you learn what it really means. And it's not camping any longer. You have no running water. You have no way to charge your electric car, which was bought with all great moral and ethical intentions. But essentially, some of the villages that Carol was just talking about, you know, they are pre-modern in our modern sense. We would be reduced to that level very quickly. And we don't have the survival training to do that. So a great deal of what I have to say comes out of the Ukraine war, of the invasion, I should say, of Ukraine, which began in 2014 and then continued in a cyber sense in the years between that and 2022. And then the full-scale military invasion happened. Europe's situation is a result of it standing up to Putin the Terrible and taking a very brave... It views it as necessary, and as John Koenig was saying, Ambassador Koenig was saying, for its own security. But it did stand up, and it did so in a very bold way and in a very self-punishing way, a very effective way, because energy exports are the source of the Russian economy. Russia is a natural resource economy. It has never stopped being that, really. Since the Soviet Union collapsed, it's lost a great majority of its manufacturing sector. It imports an enormous amount of materials that a lot of other countries produce for themselves, not just electronics, but a lot of machine parts, and a lot of just very basic appliances as well. Russia is an example, as the economist Bruno Milkovich says, of a regressed technology power. It is probably the very first one. It is getting worse all the time. Why is it getting worse? We should not forget that all Western companies, with a few dozen exceptions, but more than 1,000 Western companies who were building and making things and selling things in Russia are now gone. And I would emphasize, given my subject, that all the major Western oil companies have left Russia. Oil and gas are Russia's economic backbone and a great deal of its musculature as well. Without those companies, Russia does not have the capability to fully develop its own resources. They have been depending upon Western oil companies since the early 1990s. This is a very, very important fact. The full implications of that will take years, not many, maybe another 2 or 3 years to really show themselves. They are already showing themselves in Russia's inability to develop some of its more challenging oil and gas fields, and the future, which really lies in the Arctic. That's where Russia's enormous amount of resources exist. But you need Western technology to do that. Russia has never developed the full spectrum of oil and gas capability to develop offshore, deep ocean resources or Arctic resources. They need Western companies for that. This is very important because essentially you're taking a third leg of a three-legged chair and removing it. There is no way for Russia to be out of this at this point. In a sense, you could say their long-term fate is, if not sealed, it's been signed and delivered. And they are beginning, as you will see if you read about Russia, their central bank raised the interest rates 3.5% today. 3.5%. Yeah, one go.
Wow.
So their currency is essentially failing. Their ability to borrow outside of China is quite low. And their credit is essentially nil. It's anywhere in the West. And that's the developed world. That's the wealthy nations. So Russia is in a very bad situation. Europe began this. And you could say it, though some of my colleagues here do not like to hear it put this way, but I would call it a kind of energy war against Russia, against Mr. Putin, which is what Europe has been waging out of, again, what they consider to be necessity. But we don't give Europe, our media, and certainly the right side of the aisle, does not give Europe the credit it deserves. It's a very brave thing they did. They are essentially the main force that is destroying one of the world's worst actors in the past generation and would be in the generation from now. Destroying, I don't know, it's hard to say just yet, but it certainly looks that way. One has to really worry. After having taught history courses to undergraduates this past year, whether a scenario that emerged after World War I may be repeated in some way with the Russian people. Can you guess what I'm talking about? So the treatment of Germany after World War I, of course, was one of the key origins of World War II. Our, meaning the United States administration, did not learn that lesson when the Soviet Union collapsed. They did not support Gorbachev. This was under the first Bush administration with James Baker. It was a very bad decision they made to turn their backs on the Russians and not help out the society, the people, the leaders. The one leader that the Soviet Union ever had that we would call potentially a colleague, at least in spirit, but also in intention, Mr. Gorbachev, who also doesn't get really the credit that he deserves. But the U.S. turned its back, and Russia collapsed economically. It failed on its foreign debt in the late 1990s. And Mr. Putin is the result. And the Russia of today, with its invasions and its nuclear arsenal, is the result. And the end of any hope for any kind of simpatico or any kind of democracy under this particular gentleman, this particular person, speaks to that. So the Russian economy looks very much, for energy reasons, as if it will collapse again. What will Europe and the US do at that point? It's a very large, historical, very profound question. And it has everything to do with energy. Because once you deprive Russia of its energy resources, you are taking away more than half of its export revenues, actually more than two-thirds. And that's its lifeline. So, with that somewhat dramatic beginning, nicely illustrated by Emma here, let's talk about the situation in Europe. So the Ukraine invasion is really the first major war involving land forces, air forces, and naval forces since 1945. Ukraine is considered part of Europe as a whole, in the same way that westernmost Russia is. So this is a very large scale and historically profound event. That's however it turns out to be. Europe perceived this as exactly what it is and made the decision to counter Mr. Putin in the strongest non-military way that it knew how. And the way it did that is the way that you probably knew, that it cut its imports from Russia of natural gas, crude oil, and petroleum fuels. All three of those are critical. So natural gas and crude oil, you know, and then petroleum fuels, we're talking about gasoline and diesel and jet fuel mostly, but we're also talking about marine bunker fuel, and we're talking about military fuels. Now, it isn't as if Russia lacks all refineries, but its refineries are very outmoded, a great majority of them, and its ability to produce enormous amounts of fuel is really geared not towards its own military, because it can actually import fuels at a lower price that it can get from selling them abroad to Europe. So most of its refineries are aimed at generating these fuels for export. You understand? Yeah, I know, it seems crazy. Not crazy, but it seems as if you are giving up a very precious resource so that you can make more money. Yeah. So that's how it's viewed, as a kind of natural resource to do that. So Europe understood that it was going to face some very strong repercussions, and it did, and they were stronger than Europe thought. So the first several months, prices for oil went up, but for natural gas, they went two orders of magnitude higher. So people who were paying, let's say, actually one order of magnitude, people who were paying 25 cents, the equivalent of 25 cents for 1,000 cubic feet of gas, that number went up to $300. And we're talking about consumers as well as industries. And by the winter, by November and October, those prices were being maintained. But they'd actually begun to come down a bit. And we'll talk about why that happened. But for a number of months, there was an extreme stress on the economies of Europe in terms of its energy imports. And Europe is about 80% as a whole dependent last year on imports, particularly of oil and gas. It's only internal generators, or I should say sources, were Norway and the UK, including especially Scotland, in the North Sea. That also included, until very recently, the Netherlands, which has a very, very large gas field called Groningen, which supplied Europe with a great amount of its natural gas for decades and decades, since the 1970s. The North Sea production and the production from Groningen have been depleting very, very rapidly since around 1996. And they went down, particularly after 2000. To make up the difference, Europe began importing more gas from Russia. Now, Russia had the advantage, and it was a huge advantage, of the Soviet pipeline system, the largest in the world, which went to the Warsaw Pact, which, except for Romania, had no oil or gas at all. And so Soviet Russia giving, or almost free to the Warsaw Pact countries was a way of making them that much more dependent on the Soviet Union. But those pipeline systems were extended into Western Europe in the 1980s so that the Soviets could get hard foreign currency. This is what the elite in Russia wanted, so they could buy Western goods. And so there was a ready pipeline system for Europe to draw on and for Russia to use to supply more and more natural gas to Europe, starting in the 2000s and accelerating in the 2010s, when production from the North Sea really declined very rapidly. Now, new pipelines were built. There was the Nord Stream 1, which went from Kaliningrad, do you remember? Yeah. Under the Baltic Sea into northern Germany. There was another pipeline called Blue Stream that was built underneath the Black Sea from Russia to Turkey and then into a pipeline system that led into Eastern Europe and then distributed some of that natural gas to Western Europe as well. So those were two pincers, in a way. In the 2010s, Russia began to build the Nord Stream 2, and I'll talk about that, which just twinned the Nord Stream 1. Those are the largest pipelines, by the way, that Russia had going into Europe. Those would transport 55 billion cubic meters a year. That is an awful lot of gas. They're big. They're about this size. No, I'm a little guy. Ryan, can you?
Yeah.
No, it's about four feet in diameter, and I know that wasn't 4 feet. They're very big pipes, and they transport a lot of gas, and they were going to double that But they did build, we'll talk a little bit about the whole Nord Stream 2 debacle. They did build a second pipeline under the Black Sea called Turk Stream. And that went online, I think, in 2017. And that followed the Blue Stream as well. These pipelines were built for geopolitical reasons purposely by Gazprom, Russia's state-owned, state-run natural gas company, to go around Ukraine like a great pincer play. Because starting in the early 90s, Russia's major pipelines for natural gas went through Ukraine and a number of the oil pipelines as well. And Ukrainians were taking gas and oil out of them and not paying for all of it. And there were a great deal of conflicts going back and forth. This was during the period when Russia's economy was in very bad shape. But Ukraine's was in no better shape during that period. So you had this conflict well before the 2000s when Russia actually began to turn off the gas in the middle of winter going through Ukraine into Europe. Imagine in late January, Russia would turn it off at a very cold point in the winter for Europe. And countries like, and this includes Hungary, but also Austria and southern Germany, parts of France, and the Baltic states would lose half their gas in the middle of the winter. So they cried foul, and Russia turned the gas back on. And they did this three times between 2006 and 2013. So Russia had reason to pursue this geopolitical pincer play. But the key here is that there was a political battle going on over energy between Russia and Ukraine from almost the first year after the Soviet Union collapsed. So Russia had been showing its hand in a sense that it would use energy as a weapon. But it sent signs to Europe that Europe was off the menu for this. It's very important because they were too important. Now, Russia's exports of natural gas, even more than oil, continued to increase through the 2000s and the 2010s until Russia became the one major source that Europe relied upon most of all, thereby breaking a very important rule of geopolitical security, right? You never become too reliant on a country that is potentially your adversary for such critical resources. And so this was true for all three of those resources that I mentioned, natural gas, crude oil, and petroleum fuels. So Europe broke that rule based on the perception that Russia would never use it as a weapon against them. Why? Because Russia was equally dependent, codependent. And there were all kinds of jokes in the energy field, you know, about codependence. How do we, you know, all we have to do is get, you know, Europe and Russia to sit down in a room and go through some therapy, you know, for a while. Take a few chosen pharmaceuticals to get over their codependence. But both sides felt that they had a secure position. Now it was on this basis that Angela Merkel began pursuing the Nord Stream 2. Angela Merkel was smarter than a large number of other leaders in Europe. And I will tell you why in just a moment. We'll leave a few things hanging. So Europe's standing up to Russia and its very rapid decrease in dependence on Russian gas and oil has left it facing two very, very demanding masters for the future. Number one, is to create a new landscape of energy security and stability for its nations and citizens. That's a big order anywhere. But when you've just done what they've done, it's even more. And then to the second master is to do this in a way that moves you forward, in fact, accelerates your progress towards energy transition. To not just reduce your dependence on one source, but to actually reduce your dependence on fossil fuels. Now, you've heard that phrase a lot, right? In fact, there was an article about how quickly the U.S. is moving away from fossil fuels in the New York Times today. Okay, I have to give you some advice. That is really bullshit. That's a technical term, by the way, in energy circles. It's become that because we read it so much. And it was that very belief in magical thinking and magical happening that led Europe into its situation. The reason I say that, the U.S. is the largest producer of oil and gas in the world. Larger than Saudi Arabia. Larger than Russia. No one competes. And this has a lot to do with the shale revolution and fracking. But the U.S. is unmatched in terms of its capabilities to produce oil and gas. Moving quickly away from it? No. Building up renewables more? Yes, absolutely. And it seems nuclear power as well for its new generation. But that's something that you may want to have questions about later. I won't talk about that too much now. So Europe had these two masters to serve, right? Achieving a whole new landscape of energy security and stability. That's very important. And doing this so that it matched the energy transition, their own goals. To reduce their emissions 55% below 1990 levels by 2050. That's their major goal. Now, hey, I could stop there. That's a big challenge, isn't it? We could have a siesta. And then but you deserve some details. The idea in Europe was very strong through the 2000s, but particularly in the 2010s, that is exactly what they had already done. They had achieved a very large, or at least a very significant portion of the energy transition already. And you would read about this in the various languages. Denmark, 50%. Germany, in Mecklenburg, or Vorpommern. 110% of their electricity for 3 days was covered by wind and biogas. You would read about this again and again and again, and you would be forgiven, you should be forgiven, for believing that the future is now. And we have to remember also that Europe is not a place where there's much mining done, where there's much oil and gas drilling done. They import all of that. They import the fuels, they import the critical minerals, or they import the technologies. But they don't produce a lot of that material. And the leaders don't think that way. They don't think, for example, the way the leaders in Australia think, because that's what they think about. Because that continent is a massive resource of different critical minerals, as well as uranium and coal, natural gas, less so oil. And so Europe was led by this magical thinking. And that's a British term. They actually, the renewables are here. We're moving away from fossil fuels significantly. So, you know, our overdependence on Russia is not going to matter that much. We can deal with it. It's going to go away fairly soon, within a decade or so. Merkel was one of the only ones who understood that Europe was vastly dependent on fossil fuels to run everything. This is Germany. who was going to lead the Energiewende, right? A great turn in energy. She was a chemist, if you remember that. And so she took a scientific viewpoint, is the way it's been represented to me. And she saw what really ran cars and trucks and planes and ships. What really produced the electricity 24/7, not now and then, during the day when the wind blows, and when it does, not when it doesn't, or at nighttime when the sun isn't there. So she took a look and said, we want to move away from coal. We are a big coal-based economy. Yes, I know. I have to do something about the labor unions. They are very powerful, and the Christian Democrats, with me at their head, want to stay in power. So we'll have to do some negotiating, but the best we can do is to replace coal with natural gas, lower emissions. And if we get rid of some of our coal plants, we can reduce our emissions very rapidly, and then afterwards replace those with renewables. So this was her plan. This is how she saw things evolving. And they were evolving in that direction until 2014, when Russia began the invasion, and then certainly in 2022. But this was very opposite to many of the other people. And so she was bashed and battered, tossed against the rocks for her decision to support the Nord Stream 2. Nord Stream 2 would have given more gas than Germany needed. It would have gone to the rest of Europe. But she was the one who saw that that was necessary, and that would help reduce emissions. Whereas a great range of the others, including it in the UK before they left, just saw renewables, especially offshore wind, as taking care of everything. The one really serious mistake she made was to cancel all the nuclear power. That actually led to an increase in coal use. And so she has to bear that burden a little bit.
Yeah, but that's what the people wanted.
That is what the people wanted. That is not what the people needed. But it's Germany, and anti-nuclearism is part of the German DNA at this point. Yeah. Yes?
I think, didn't you give a talk 2 years ago about energy in Europe? And Germany, they actually rely on a certain amount of electricity generated by French nuclear power plants.
That's right.
Probably.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Europe went up against Russia, and they cut their natural gas imports by 70% in 8 months. And they suffered the consequences, but when winter came last year, it was a very gentle arrival. The winter was warmer than usual. Nonetheless, as some of you may remember, the governments asked everyone to turn down the thermostat and to use their appliances less, basically conserve as much as they could, and they did. And they decreased their overall electricity use 18%, which is a huge amount. And that helped them weather the winter, even though it was still gentle. So they benefited from their own actions and also from luck. There is no guarantee that this winter will be the same at all. And they understand, the leaders understand, including Dame Ursula, who I think deserves an awful lot of our admiration, though she can go too far in some directions. She is definitely the real Iron Lady, I think, at this point in history. They will act as if the winter will be cold. That is the best protection and that is her decision. We'll have to see how that will work out. The governments probably can't afford to subsidize energy use the way they did last winter to the same degree. It was hard on a lot of poor people.
Yes.
Bread or gas, you know, food or heat. But it didn't last that long. But again, there's no guarantee. So what are the EU plans? What do they see must be done? And this is where things get to be a little bit disappointing from an energy expert's point of view. They have a plan called RE Power EU, and the RE is capitalized because that stands for renewable. And the core of this is a massive investment in renewables, meaning mostly offshore wind and solar power. And the reason why energy experts are very disappointed in that is these are unreliable sources. Okay, you can't depend on them 1 second to the next. You can't run a city on them without massive amounts of storage whose technology we do not yet have.
So they're not that far along in that regard.
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet. One of the best policy ideas they have is heat pumps. But as I mentioned before, they really need to support that. That would be an area where government financial support would make a big difference. In the same way that the IRA in the US, what does that stand for? The Inflation Reduction Act, nothing. It has nothing to do with Ireland. they're neutral, remember? and Europe is actually kind of upset about that because some of their companies are moving over here and take advantage of that. EVs and e-bikes. So the EU is the second largest purchaser of EVs after China, and the US is third. But that is a focus, so that will be supported. Various forms of nuclear power are being discussed, but France and Germany are almost going to war over this. It is really hot between them. And I'll give you my take on that in just a moment. And then they are making a demand for efficiency. So that all countries in the EU, this is the EU, not all of Europe, reduce their total energy consumption each year by 1.5%. Which doesn't mean that they give up sources or keep the thermostats down to 65. It does mean that the average house with its appliances starts buying things that are much more efficient. Now, the Germans have a program, the French do, the British do, like the US does. They have programs that actually determine which are the best and most efficient and most cost effective for purchase by consumers. It's called the Energy Star program here. Japan has one too. And so this is being discussed as a possibility for the EU as a whole. So that people make the right purchases. And Europe is a place where this might happen. The US? No. Come on, you know the answer. So a large portion of the US would probably do this. But a small portion, you know, which wears red hats, would probably say that the rest of us are coming to take away their prized possessions, you know, their natural gas stoves or whatever. But Europe may lead with in some of these policy choices. Some of them are very good. The nuclear problem remains, and that is one of the challenges. Europe is very divided. You have all of Eastern Europe, which is pro-nuclear. Poland has a plan to build 16 reactors. It has none right now. Finland is very pro. Sweden has become pro. Norway doesn't need them. or maybe it does, because Norway gets its electricity from hydropower. But this has proved to be a real problem in Europe, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Let me recommend that you don't book any trips down the Rhine or the Rhone or portions of the Danube, because they are way low and the normal ship traffic is stopped in many portions of these rivers. So Norway's actual ability to generate power is much less than it used to be, and hydropower as a whole is suffering a significant amount of constraint in Europe with the continued heat wave and the drought, which continues from last summer. And so the predictions now are that Europe is going to be the area of the world that heats up the most in the next 30 years.
Scott.
Yeah.
So are they, given that maybe different members have different needs or variations in needs, is the EU successful in, I mean, this could, I guess you could talk about this in a lot of different sectors, but collectively, are they able to come up with some consensus, even if it involves compromise by different members on some sort of collective energy policy?
Yeah, that's what they're trying to do.
Okay.
It's proved very, very difficult. And it's not just about nuclear, but it is. Finland particularly wants wood pellets, right, to be included in green energy,
right,
even though you're burning carbon. But they have a huge forestry industry. Germany wants there to be biogas, even though you're burning agricultural waste. And a lot of that has been shown to have marginal, at best, returns or savings, carbon savings, I should say. So there are still lots of things to iron out, to work out. There are lots of wrinkles. We tend to forget Europe is full of these nations that have been, you know, sort of not necessarily at war, but full of nationalism for the extent of the modern period, ever since the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648, and before, if you're talking about England and France and Spain. So getting them all on the same page is always going to be difficult. And energy is a very, very nationalized resource, or I should say expense, for a lot of them. I will say that I am not convinced that they really understand that solar and wind and now even hydro are not reliable for the future, and they will not replace fossil fuels by themselves. They need some sort of backup, or they need technology. And even if they get storage, are they going to be able to generate the redundant amounts of power that need to be stored for when they go down? There are wind droughts in the North Sea. Anybody heard about those?
I haven't.
Yeah. Yeah. So there, Ryan, did you say yes? Sorry.
I haven't heard about wind droughts.
Okay. I'm sorry, yeah. So there are predictions that at least a 10% overall lowering of wind generation capability will be suffered by Europe in the next 20 to 30 years. And that was part of last year's price rise and increased need for natural gas, was a wind drought. Wasn't huge, wasn't the largest by any means. So I'm not dissing renewables. They're necessary, absolutely. And in certain places, they are a very rich natural resource, and they add to, you know, local resilience. But they are not enough by themselves. And it's magical thinking that they can run a modern economy. And that needs to be understood, I think. So that understanding looks like one of the challenges ahead. Solving the nuclear problem in a positive way, that is a challenge ahead. Another challenge is their vulnerability to pricing for natural gas, also oil. Those are not disappearing soon. And that needs to be faced. And then, this will not be any surprise to you, critical minerals. Because Europe does not generate them by itself. And now the move is to escape China's dominance of the market. And that's a geopolitical problem. Is it being overdone? This is a huge question, right, in the whole foreign policy area. Is it being overdone? Are people demonizing China too much? You saw John, you heard Ambassador Koenig say he thought that problem had been transferred from the Soviet Union to China, and a lot of people agree with that. So where is Europe going to get its critical minerals from? Are there spots where they exist? Yes, in Europe. Will they spend the money and bend the environmental rules? Because mining gets your hands dirty, right? There is no such thing as green mining.
It seems like there's been, if you've read a lot of the articles the last couple of years about the Russian interests in mining, in, you know, if you think about certain African countries, where there have these interesting relationships occurring with authoritarian leaders who are allowing them, like, access to mines and things like that.
Right.
Like in the Sahel region or...
Mm-hmm.
So.
Whereas at home, here in the U.S., we have a very... And this is an example of some of the problems that Europe will face. It's already faced these in terms of citing large wind farms in the north of Scandinavia and the conflict with the Sami up there, Sami that use reindeer as their main food source and clothing source. So in the U.S., we are not without critical minerals. This is a very rich, North America is a very rich continent that way. But we do have political opposition to mining. So there is a very large lithium deposit in northwestern Nevada called the Thatcher Pass area. And there is a mining company ready, who's leased some of the land and ready to develop this lithium deposit, but the local native tribes are very against it. And what do you do? Who wins? And for how long? So is the U.S., as Edward Luce, the U.S. correspondent for the Financial Times, which I recommend, it's a great paper. Not about financial stuff, but because I don't know shit about that, but excuse me. But their coverage about world events and everything. He says the U.S. has terminal NIMBYism. Is it true or is it not? It seems true. It is in the way of developing offshore wind, that's for sure. And we are way behind the pack when it comes to that. We have huge resources. But those wealthy liberals on Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard, ooh, they don't want to see that. Actually, this is true. It's an example. So, that's not Europe, but Europe will face those problems. It already is.
Another question is there any issue in Europe, as there is here, about the siting of the giant server farm in Germany? Because that was used.
You know, I have not read that is as much a problem as it has been. Not a problem, an issue as it has been here.
Because mm-hmm. And then the other thing I was reading about was the weight of vehicles that, at least in the U.S., are being sold as EVs. They're significantly heavier in their tonnage compared to prior vehicles, which creates a different issue around infrastructure.
Oh, absolutely. No, very good.
Yeah, like your road's already suffering from heat, and you put a vehicle on that weighs 1,000 pounds more.
Well, that wouldn't apply to Seattle, because our roads are in such great shape here. Right? Yes, that excellent point. Not only that, they want to build all the EVs as large vehicles, so they use up a lot more mining, a lot larger consumption of critical minerals and steel and aluminum as well, and plastic. Our cars have lots of plastic in them. Don't forget petrochemicals. That's oil and gas so far. Anyway, so those are the major challenges. Should I go over them one time? There's the summer heat and the drought. That's a challenge to renewables, including hydro. There are the critical minerals, a challenge there. There's the battle over nuclear. And there's the magical thinking, the sorcerer's apprentice. So in the very last analysis, it may and it may not, but it may turn out that the greatest risk to long-term energy security in Europe is Europe itself. But it may not. And I'm hoping and thinking that it won't wind up that way. So thank you for listening. I went a little... Oh, no, I'm
You're
okay.
Good.
I'm okay. Okay. So any last questions?
Any other final questions?